To Matthew chapter 7, and study with us, think with us as we consider the words of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount. Before we get to that, though, I have a couple of extra announcements. One, a note handed to me. Lori Williams is back in the hospital under the care of a neurologist trying to find out why she can't walk. And her problems just seem to be ongoing. And certainly the family, I know, is in need of our encouragement, our words and prayers of support. And hopefully that Lori can find some relief from the various problems that she's been having. Also, Zachary Newman is in the hospital, was hospitalized over the weekend with some asthma issues, and I believe is still in. So we might want to keep the Newmans in our prayers as well. As Jesus began the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5, he set forth some positive characteristics of those who would be in God's spiritual kingdom. And then it seems pretty much like in the rest of the sermon, what he has to teach further about that spiritual kingdom is against the backdrop, particularly of the Pharisees, but of the Jewish leadership in that day. And so I suppose to some degree we could say this is a negative message, as we sometimes like to categorize preaching and teaching as negative and positive. But an awful lot of what Jesus says about what truly should be so in the kingdom is negatively stated against what was commonly thought in that day of being in God's kingdom. In fact, I think one of the core thoughts is in Matthew 5 and verse 20. I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. And it's this kind of teaching that put Jesus at odds with the Jewish leadership. They really resented this sort of in-your-face kind of teaching. And I think it was very, very confrontational. Not that Jesus was ugly in spirit, but it was very confrontational. It was diametrically opposed to what the Jewish leaders were teaching their people about being in the kingdom. So Jesus, from Matthew 5:20 on, he begins to talk about the proper way to look at the law of God. And he talks about the traditions that have been taught to the people. You've heard that this was said about the law, but I say unto you, and he puts the proper interpretation on the meaning of the law. That goes on through chapter 5 and six of these contrasts back and forth. Then in chapter 6, he's talking about kingdom righteousness relative to worship. And he's pointing out the hypocritical practices of the scribes and the Pharisees and how they pray in public to be seen. And they give alms so that everybody will see how benevolent they are. And they fast and make sure everybody knows that they're fasting for the impression they make on others. And Jesus said, this is not kingdom righteousness. We should first and foremost serve God and not draw attention to ourselves. God will see and God will reward, and that should be our concern. Not what other people are seeing and not how they respond to us. So Jesus talks about the law, properly understanding. He talks about worship and properly understanding that. Latter part of chapter 6, he talks about how to properly understand this material world in which we live. Because we're told in the Gospels that the Jewish leadership was very materialistic. They loved money. And that motivated them in so many things that they did. And so Jesus said, look, you don't need to worry about the things of this life. You need to seek first the kingdom. And if your value structure is correct, God will provide you with what you need. And you need to make sure that you don't put too much attention on these other things, because you can't serve God and mammon or riches, though men insist on trying. You can't do that. You've got to have, and you will have, one master. So he talks about our view of an attitude toward material things. Then we come to chapter 7. And I think Jesus now is turning his attention to how we look at other people. And again, I think this is against the backdrop of the Pharisees and other Jewish leaders. Because we're told, again, in various places in the Gospels, the leadership despised the common people. They weren't viewing their positions as a stewardship to serve others. They saw it as self-aggrandizement and the ability to be seen as a powerful and influential person. And we're told that the Pharisees particularly despised others. and thought that they were ignorant and uneducated and not on their level. And I think what Jesus says about properly assessing people here is against the prevailing notion of the Pharisaic leadership that it's all about me and you, the rest of you are just peons. Now, with that thought in mind, Jesus says, "Judge not that you be not judged. For with what judgment you judge, you will be judged, and with the same measure you use, it will be measured back to you. And why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye, but do not consider the plank in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, 'Let me remove the speck out of your eye,' and look, a plank is in your own eye?" And here's a key: hypocrite. Hypocrite. "First, remove the plank from your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck out of your brother's eye. Do not give what is holy to the dogs, nor cast your pearls before swine, lest they trample them under their feet and turn and tear you to pieces." Politicians often complain about being quoted out of context. Well, boy, is Jesus ever quoted out of context here. Probably no more so anywhere else than right here. And if people don't know anything else about the Bible, they know it says, "Judge not, that you be not judged." And the only reason they want to quote that is to justify themselves in doing what they're doing and avoid criticism for it. But I'm telling you, the context of what Jesus means is here, and we got to see it. And you know, I've said this several times through the study, and I hope that I've created the proper impression in saying it. But I've said, we can see what Jesus says. The question is, what does He mean? So often you can take the words of the Lord and rip them out of the context and quote them and come up with something that would be bizarre in the implementation. If your right eye offends you, pluck it out. The question is not what He says. We all can read what He says. The question is, what does He mean when He says it? "Judge not that you be not judged." The idea that Jesus forbids all judgments of other men under any circumstances is contradictory to His own teaching in the sermon. Especially with what will come after this. It's also contrary to His practice. And we can't dismiss that simply by saying, "Oh, well, you know, He's the Son of God." There are certain judgments of other people that are commanded of us. And I will suggest to you that just being a human being in this world demands that we make certain judgments about others. We must assess the people that we work with, that we live with, that we associate with, to ensure our own happiness, our safety, our success. We are constantly judging the competence of other people. We judge the doctor to be trustworthy or not. We judge the salesman to be telling us the truth or not. We judge our mates, hopefully before we marry them, to be trustworthy, to be able to make such a commitment as we're entering into with them. We judge them in various ways to be compatible to us. We gauge a lot of different things when we are trying to measure properly other people in the relationships we sustain with them. Sometimes it's fine inflection. We can tell speech inflection. We can tell what somebody else is thinking or going to do. We can tell by body language, eye contact, demeanor, consistency of behavior. All of these things we, in the normal course of our day, we're looking at to evaluate people to make sure that our interaction with them is not detrimental to us. But what Jesus is saying here is qualified as we go along. He says, specifically, do not judge hypocritically. And He's already used the term hypocrite in this sermon to refer to the Jewish leadership, particularly the Pharisees. He talked about them as hypocrites when they prayed on the street corner, really to be seen by men, but pretending to speak to God. And that's what a hypocrite is a pretender. We need to make sure that we're not one thing internally and another thing externally. And what happens in making judgments in this regard is, oftentimes we judge others harshly who are doing the very same things that we're doing in a more hidden way in our own minds, and we justify ourselves over and against what we perceive to be the failures or the mistakes of other people. You notice he says, judge not that you be not judged. For, now he's going to explain that a little bit further, for with what judgment you judge, you will be judged. And with the same measure you use, it will be measured back to you. In other words, when you make certain judgments about other people in this life, beware. They're making judgments about you. Judgments are going to be made about you in return. So just make sure you're on an even playing field here. If we're quick to find fault and we're quick to point out the mistakes and the weaknesses of other people, just know there are people looking at you the same way. And what he says is there's going to be a tendency, just because it's human nature, there's going to be a tendency to receive from others the same kind of treatment we give to them. He's not saying whether that's right or wrong. He's just saying that is. That is the way it is. And if I am compassionate and I'm understanding and I can give slack and I can overlook faults and I can basically absorb the imperfections and impurities in the lives of other people without being harshly critical, the likelihood is that's the kind of judgment that's going to be used against me by them. On the other hand, there's no pleasure among people of this world quite like catching someone in an inconsistency. You see this in politics all the time. Some politician will poke out his chest and blow up, swell up, and start roundly condemning, you know, his colleagues for this and that and the other, only to be found out later that he's guilty of the very thing he's been criticizing others of. And boy, do the enemies like that. They love to point that out when they see that kind of inconsistency. And I think Jesus is basically giving a proverb or a maxim here about life. You're going to get what you give. You're going to reap what you sow is another way the Bible puts it. But perhaps even on a deeper level than that, we're told even in the Sermon on the Mount that God will respond to us in certain ways according to how we act. In chapter 5, in verse 7, blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. God is looking for that quality. And if He sees mercy, it's going to suggest to Him the right kind of faith exists in that person, on which a relationship with Him can be established. He's going to be more prone to show mercy to those who are merciful. In chapter 6 and verse 15, this is after he gives the sample prayer. He says, well, actually, verse 14, if you forgive men their trespasses, your heavenly Father will also forgive you. But if you do not forgive men their trespasses, neither will your Father forgive your trespasses. So there's very definitely a correlation between how we treat other people and how God responds to us. But I think verse 2 specifically of Matthew 7 has more in mind the proverbial application. That as we judge others, the same kind of judgment will be coming back toward us in return. Now, in verses 3 through 5, Jesus further explains what kind of judgment he's talking about. Why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye and do not consider the plank in your own eye? And again, it's an exaggeration. Jesus often exaggerates to make a point. It's an exaggeration, and here's the idea of someone. And perhaps there's a little bit of humor in this. Some commentators say Jesus is using a bit of humor in what he's trying to say here. But you catch the inconsistency, don't you, when if you can visualize someone who's got a 2x4 poking out of their eyes, and they're trying to take the finger of someone else and work out a little splinter. They're trying to hear their, you know. And the idea of hypocrisy is in this illustration of Jesus. to be guilty of the very thing that I'm trying to suggest to you. This is not a statement to say we must be faultless. And sometimes that's quoted from John 8 with a woman taken in adultery. You who are without sin, cast the first stone. Another destruction of the context in which Jesus is speaking. But Jesus is not saying, until you're perfect, don't criticize anybody else. What he's saying is, when you make certain judgments, make sure that you're making them on the proper grounds. That's what he meant in John 8, too. The people that brought that woman in adultery were rotten to the core. And they were using that woman as a tool to get at Jesus. They had no intention of following the law relative to adulteresses. What they were wanting to do is use that woman in her sinfulness, which was showing a complete disdain and lack of compassion for her. And Jesus said, in this matter, if you're without sin, the law says stone them. Go ahead. And what he's saying here is essentially the same thing. And it's a matter, seemingly, a common matter in human nature. I'm not sure what the psychology is and all that. Probably self-justification to a certain extent. But we can so clearly see what's wrong in the life of someone else. And I'm not saying we're necessarily wrong in what we see. We can look at other people, and from a more objective standpoint, yes, we do have the problem of not seeing the matter exactly according to how that person sees it, and we're not taking into account all the pressures and stresses and strains and complexities that, you know, aren't obvious on the outside. But the problem we have sometimes is not seeing what's wrong in the life of someone else. It's seeing it and exaggerating it and treating them a certain way or talking about it to everybody else when we ourselves, on some level, are guilty of what we're finding fault in another. And perhaps we do this in order to make ourselves feel better about ourselves. We exaggerate what this other person is doing because it makes me feel better about my relatively minor infraction of the same principle. But you notice Jesus says about this man with the board in his eyes trying to pick the splinter out of someone else. He says, hypocrite, again, which I think has the Pharisees particularly in mind, hypocrite, first remove the plank from your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck out of your brother's eye. He's not saying don't judge at all, or don't try to correct, or don't try to help someone over a weakness or a problem. What he's saying is don't be a hypocrite. Look to yourself first. Make sure that you yourself are not guilty. Because I'm telling you, if we are guilty of the same thing, we will not be listened to. We will not be successful in trying to create the proper impression on someone else who may have a splinter in their finger. He's not denying the splinter is there. They have a problem. And until we can help get that splinter out, we've got to make sure that we're not going to be told in return, who are you to be telling me that I need to take this splinter out of my finger? Oh, you with the 2x4 sticking out of your eye. This is human nature, and we've got to be careful about it. We've got to be honest with ourselves before God as to what is in our eye or not in our eye. And thereby, as we're trying to be consistent and citizens of the kingdom with the character that comes with it, that we're trying to be honest and pure, first of all, before God. And then we will be able to help others with their problems. So Jesus, in verses 3 through 5 particularly, is warning against being hypocritical and too extreme. And that comes with hypocrisy. Exaggerating what somebody else is doing so I feel better about my own relatively minor flight. But now what are we going to do with verse 6? Because I'll tell you, verse 6 tells us to make judgments. So if you get somebody in a conversation and they're real quick, they won't be able to tell you, I'm sure, where it is. They just know the Bible says, judge not that you be not judged. But you know it's in Matthew 7:1. Go ahead and take them a few verses down to verse 6. And some others we'll talk about later in the chapter, but not this morning. But Jesus in verse 6 says, do not give what is holy to the dogs, nor cast your pearls before swine, lest they trample them under their feet and turn, and tear you to pieces. If I understand this correctly at all, I think what Jesus is doing is warning against two extremes. The first extreme is to be hypocritically severe. The second extreme in verse 6 is not to be naive. Don't be so oblivious to other people and what they are and what they can be that you don't make any judgment about them when you ought to. Jesus here says a judgment has got to be made as to who is a dog and who is a hog. Do not give what is holy to the dogs, nor cast your pearls before swine. You know, this kind of language, again, I know what Jesus said, but the question is, what does he mean? Is he talking about animals? You remember when Peter had the vision of the great sheet being let down from heaven, and he saw on the sheet all kinds of unclean animals? And later, when he reflects on this, he draws the conclusion that animals really weren't in the picture after all. It was men. Same thing here. Jesus is not talking about dogs and hogs. He's talking about people. But I want you to see, he's talking about people who demonstrate themselves to be unappreciative of and unworthy of spiritual truth and spiritual insight. First of all, Jesus himself at times refused to interact with people that he determined to be unspiritual or unscrupulous in their attitudes. You remember during his trial, he's brought before Herod. Pilate's wanting to wash his hands of the matter. And since Herod is the Tetrarch of Galilee, he sends Jesus over to Herod, who happens to be in Jerusalem at that time. And I'll deal with this. I'll let Herod take care of the case. And so Jesus is led over to Herod. And of course, all Herod wants to do in his debauched and crazy frame of mind is he just wants to see a miracle. Show me a magic trick. You remember what Jesus said to Herod? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. He was not going to indulge. He wasn't even going to respond. And the proverb, answer not a fool according to his folly, comes to mind. But you know, there are a lot of good proverbs that basically teach this same point. There are people that you need to get away from. There are people you do not need to interact with, not because you are hypocritically judging them, but because you have reason to make a determination. It has been demonstrated in their speech or their actions. This person has no appreciation for spiritual things whatsoever. And to try to answer that person and deal with them is going to, in one way or another, probably reflect badly upon you. Jesus also, on another occasion, was challenged as to authority. His authority. By what authority, you know, do you do these things? And remember, Jesus wouldn't answer that directly. In fact, Jesus oftentimes wouldn't answer directly. He would answer in such a way that would try to bring into light the lack of spirituality in those challenging him. But to try to get into a reasoned debate with people that had no interest in reasoning about spiritual things, Jesus simply wouldn't do. Sometimes Jesus rebuked. Sometimes he said very little. But he always refused to play the game of those who were not spiritual. So Jesus says, do not give what is holy to the dogs or cast your pearls before swine. In fact, he goes on and says, to try to engage them on a spiritual plane might even result in their, in the case of the swine, their turning and tearing you to pieces. The point is, maybe among others, I think sometimes we try to win the unwinnable. We try to teach the unteachable. And it's usually people that we're emotionally wrapped up with. It's family members, friends. And there's absolutely, certainly, nothing wrong with compassion and a merciful frame of mind, a desire to teach them. But Jesus is giving us permission. When whatever we might deem to be, with the right spirit, we might deem to be a reasonable attempt to teach someone the truth, Jesus gives us permission to shake the dust off our feet, as Paul did, and go on to someone else. The judgment, let me say again, must not be hypocritical. It must not be shallow. It must not be my own apathy. Well, I just don't want to do it. Well, I don't want to give it. No, it's not that. When, in all sincerity and in all honesty, the attempt has been made to deal with someone on a spiritual level, either in conversion or just simply trying to deal with a co-worker in the office or whoever it may be, but you're trying to uphold a spiritual principle with someone that's got no spiritual inclinations, there comes a time when the Lord gives permission to say, enough is enough. It is obvious to me, by the judgment in the situation, it's obvious to me this person has no spiritual interest or inclination, and it is fruitless for me to keep on trying. And so there's a time when you just have to say, that's it, and move on to someone else. This observation was made by someone else. To give pearls to swine is to press the claims of the gospel upon those who despise it until they persecute you for annoying. I'm going to tell you, nobody's ever going to be annoyed into the kingdom. Jesus didn't do it. All of Jesus chasing after someone who turned and walked away from Him? Did He grieve over the rich young ruler who turned away? Yes. Did He chase him down and verbally try to beat him into submission? No. But you know, we tend to be very uncomfortable about this concept. And I think the reason we tend to is because we tend to think that if they're lost, we're personally responsible for that. And the Lord is freeing us from that responsibility. Now, we may be responsible for not trying. We may be responsible for not teaching someone, not approaching someone, but when the effort is made, Ken Craig said some really good things about this yesterday in sharing with us his ideas about evangelism. But when the gospel is presented, and it's presented in the right spirit, with love for that person's soul, and they turn and walk away, there is no need to beat yourself up over that. The Lord gives them permission to turn and walk away. It's called free will. The Lord gives them permission to turn and walk away, and the Lord gives us permission to turn and walk away. Not necessarily to close a door forever, but to say the opportunity has been given. And the response of the person has demonstrated that they're unworthy. We want everybody to be saved that will be saved. The problem is, not everyone will choose to be saved. Then in verses 7 through 12, we've got again some things of Jesus. Anything Jesus say, can it not be taken out of context in one way or another? Ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you'll find. Knock and it will be open to you. I think what essentially is being said here is our life in the kingdom consists of almost endless search and supply. We're constantly searching for the things that are needed, and the promise is given here that God will supply it. Now, how do we look at this asking and seeking and knocking? First of all, let's not yank it out of the context like we may tend to want to do, and make this then a wish list. Whatever I want, or whatever concerns me in life, whatever my interests are, ask. It'll be given. Seek, you'll find. Knock, and it'll be open to you. Do you not think it would be better contextually to look at this as the very things that Jesus has been talking about in this sermon? That is to say, Jesus is trying to tell us how to be citizens in a spiritual kingdom. That's what this sermon is about. And it goes without saying, though I'll say it, this is not the be-all and end-all of being in the kingdom. It's a broad, sweeping sermon, but there's a lot of other issues, a lot of other depth we can go into. But Jesus is trying to set forth some basic principles and truths about being in the spiritual kingdom against the backdrop of the misunderstanding that existed among the Jewish leaders. But Jesus has been saying, seek for the qualities of meekness and mercy and purity. Is it easy to achieve those qualities in our lives? He said we need to have an appetite for righteousness. Hunger and thirst for righteousness. Do you do that? I mean, is that easy to have a hunger for righteousness like we have a hunger for a hamburger? One is a natural inclination. The other one must be created. The spiritual hunger. That's a decision we make. Jesus has said that we need to glorify God by our works, even if it means that we suffer and are persecuted in that. Jesus has said we need to have the courage to love our enemies. Is that easy? But yet, that's the standard, so that we may be like God. You may be sons of your Father in heaven. He says a genuine relationship with God, part of which is worshiping from the heart because we desire to interact with God on that level. Did you do that this morning when we were singing and praying and partaking of the Lord's Supper? Did I do that? Did I worship the way I should have this morning? Is it easy to do that all the time? Jesus said we need to not focus so much on the material things of life, but seek first the kingdom. Is that easy to do? Do you think in all honesty you're seeking the kingdom first in your life? And then he talked about making these judgments. Who's a dog and who's a hog? And how careful do I have to be about not being a hypocrite when I look and see all the faults of everybody else? Is that easy? No, it's not easy. That's why the Pharisees were taking all these shortcuts. True righteousness is not easy to achieve in your life. But now Jesus says, ask, it'll be given to you. Seek and you'll find. Knock, it'll be open to you. If you're wanting the things that you ought to want, if you're wanting the things that are of true substance in this life, which has to do with being in the kingdom and being in a relationship with God, you seek those things and God will provide them. Everyone who asks, for everyone who asks receives, and he who seeks finds. To him who knocks, it'll be opened. Or, and now he gives this comparison between men and God. What man is there among you who, if his son asks for bread, will give him a stone? Jesus talks about the human relationship to make a point about God. And he says, quite rudely, but truthfully, you're evil. The human beings are beset with evil and ungodliness. And yet, when your own child approaches you for what is a genuine need, do you give him something that just resembles what he really needs and then laugh in his face when he realizes he's been fooled by dad? No, you give your children anything and everything they need, even if it's like the Newmans, I suppose, spending all night last night awake in a hospital and making sure their child is well and not afraid. You do what it takes to provide what your children really need. Now, do you give them everything they want? No. Do you break your back to give them what they really need and make sure they're really being cared for internally? Yes. We do. And he said, don't you think God will do the same thing? Don't you think God will give you what you need? The trick is to bring our wants into alignment with our true needs before God. To want what God wants us to have. That's the challenge. But you know what? If we do, God's not going to sit there and say, well, I just want you to beg. You know, put the bone on the nose of the dog and make him sit there, you know, till you say, okay, boy. God doesn't play games like that. God will gladly and abundantly give us the things that we need. But we need to make sure we're pursuing the right things. And I think this is still being said in this context of how we treat other people. Because he comes back in verse 12. Therefore, whatever you want men to do to you, do also to them, for this is the law and the prophets. And I can't help but hear in that, this is the law and the prophets, not what you're being told by the Pharisees and scribes. This is the law and the prophets. You treat other people as you would want them to treat you. And I think this is, I guess I can show you some of this in outline. This is the core ethic. It's not the only standard, it's not the only principle by which we engage with other people. He's already given some other ones. Don't give what's holy to the dogs. Make sure you judge unhypocritically. But at the root of all of that is we should want and actively do. This is not just an attitude, you see, in verse 12. It's not just an attitude. Feel this way about other people. It is an active principle. Whatever you want people to do for you, do it for them. And so, we have this principle resting, I think, on the relationship that we sustain with God. Number one, we receive from God what we needed and not what we deserved. This is how we should respond to other people. What do they need? Not what they deserve. We should not look at other people from the selfish standpoint and say, would this person do this for me if I were in their shoes? That isn't the standard. It's not some hypothetical, would they or wouldn't they? The standard is not, did he do that for me when I was in that situation? That's do unto others as they do unto you, or don't do unto others as they didn't do to you. It's not negative. It's not a passive standard. It's not just refrain from hurting people, which seems to be so much the standard of our society. Well, you can do whatever you want to do, just make sure you don't hurt anybody. It's interesting what definitions people put on hurting someone else. Oh, I can do this because I'm not hurting them. I can give somebody drugs because I'm helping them. They need a fix, and I'm helping. You can justify anything under the standard of just so long as you don't hurt somebody. But Jesus' standard exceeds all of that. He says, look inside of yourself honestly and unhypocritically and ask yourself, what would I want someone to do for me in that situation? And then he says, you do that. You do that. And certainly we could look at this standard and say, how much of this world's ills would be satisfied, corrected, if that one teaching of Jesus would be implemented? Just that one. One simple statement. How much wretchedness in this world would not be done if more people had the spiritual kingdom outlook and just simply treated other people actively according to what they know they would like in that situation, would like to be done to them. But really, I think the principle goes much deeper than that. It's not just to cure all the ills of society, but it's to help bring me into alignment with the will of God. If I have this motive in my heart, if I operate on this principle, I think what Jesus is saying is, you have the spirit of the kingdom. You have the spirit of the kingdom. You are ensuring in that view of other people and in the life that comes out of that view that you are the kind of person God wants you to be. These standards of Jesus are not just nice platitudes. It's not that people were sitting out on the hillside just thinking, this is just great, man. I just wish he'd keep on talking. He was drilling to the heart of the human soul and confronting people with what really lay deep down underneath. And that's what I hope these lessons are helping us do. What is in here, in my heart? Who am I really? Because Jesus just peels away the layers. He just peels it away. And if you don't like what you see in the peeling away of those layers, if you see that you're not of the character and the attitude and the lifestyle of one who God is looking for to be in His kingdom, we want to extend the invitation of the Lord to you this morning to come to Him. Use this opportunity to make a change in your life, make this a turning point. So many things we intend to do one day. We intend to work on it. We intend to be better. We intend to improve. When? And how many false promises have you made to yourself and to God? If you're not a Christian, use this opportunity to make a stand and make a change in your life and devote yourself to God and to the principles of the spiritual kingdom that Jesus is talking about here. And if we can help you in that, the water is in the baptistry and people are here to hear your confession that Jesus is the Son of God and to encourage you and lift up your spirit and help you in this new beginning. Can we do that for you this morning? Can we help you in any of the ways? We stand and sing.